Welcome back again to Principles of Environmental Toxicology. I'm Greg Muller, professor for the course. And today's lecture is our annual Socrates Award lecture. This is for 2005. And as the students know, this lecture is different for a whole lot of reasons. One, in that we give the students the throttle, so to speak, the gas pedal on this lecture in an election. And that election is based on some principles that we give here for the Socrates Award lecture. And Socrates was a fellow in ancient Greece. We've talked about a little bit, and there's some information on the course website, who was very outspoken and participated actively in discussions of the issues of the day in the public arena. Socrates also met his demise, perhaps because he didn't know when to keep his mouth shut, in that he was executed in ancient Greece by drinking the poison hemlock, and therefore the relationship to environmental toxicology. In the Socrates Award, what we tried to do actually is do the toxin or poison of the year. Many of you that are see in the media the almost monthly and sometimes even more often reports of the newest, latest health scare. Some of these actually are quite reasonable in terms of public health education, alerting us to some practices, some behaviors, or some chemicals or products of great concern in terms of human risk. Quite often, however, these reports are nothing more than hyping the latest sort of scare thing to perhaps sell newspapers or advertisements. And so we have to be critical in our thinking in terms of how a chemical that's automatically labeled in the media a toxic chemical, what that means in terms of things like dose response and real epidemiological and real risk. Hopefully, this course has given you the tools to do that critical thinking, to do the analysis, to get beyond the headlines, so to speak. Well, one of the things we'd like to do in the Socrates Award is actually identify, by student vote, that chemical, poison, toxin, the public health issue of greatest concern over the past 12 months. And so we hold an election, have students vote on what this lecture will be. And the criteria for the award is that this has to be a chemical, a pathogen, a group of chemicals of great concern that has appeared in the media. It can be a hyped situation, or it can be just an accurate sense of reporting of a clear and present danger, if you will. And so what we try to do is actually incorporate this as being a current event toxicology lecture. Well, today's Socrates Award lecture for 2005, the title is Prions and Public Health, and most of you have actually heard of prions. If you haven't heard of them as prions, you've heard of them in the media as mad cow disease. It begs the question to me, and although I know a little bit how that name, which appears in the media, was coined, that in fact it does load the analysis of that particular disease manifestation in livestock in terms of how we reflect on it in terms of our personal risks associated with eating meat products. Obviously, we don't want to go mad. But in fact, this is a very complex disease, and in fact, in the late 80s, it was the subject of a Nobel Prize award in terms of unearthing a very interesting pathology associated with this new contaminant in the food supply. It's an animal disease vector, and it made its appearance in human disease as well. This morning, we are very grateful to have an outside lecturer, Professor Jill Johnson, delivering the Socrates Award lecture for 2005. Professor Johnson actually did her undergraduate work at the Mayo Clinic and then went on to the University of Wisconsin in molecular biology. She's here at the University of Idaho in the microbiology, molecular biology, and biochemistry department, and her area of research is in chaperone proteins and in folding of proteins, and you'll see how that is intricately involved with prions and, might I say, bad prions and their behavior and their relationship to public health. With that, Dr. Johnson, thank you very much.
Thank you, Greg.
Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Hi, like I said, my name is Jill Johnson, and I'd like to give you just a first brief introduction to what I do. So I basically am a molecular biologist, biochemist, working in protein folding diseases. And so my relationship with prions has really come about from it is a protein folding disease, but it happens to actually be a transmissible protein folding disease. And so what I'd like to tell you a little bit about is the history of prion diseases, and then a little bit of the aspects that are more focused into public health and how that might actually fit into kind of the broader concept of this course. So let's see, let's just start off here. So just some background. First of all, so a lot of people have heard about protein fold or prion diseases, but they don't really know what the background is. And so I wanted to give a little bit of background of what exactly a prion is, what the infectious agent is in prions. So Greg talked about having different sort of chemicals or toxins. What's really unique about prion diseases is that it's a change in a protein that's already within your body and within your brain that's being altered in a way to then propagate and cause diseases. And this is really a very novel mechanism of causing diseases and infectivity, and so I'd like to go over that a little bit. And since you all have pretty much heard of mad cow disease, I wanted to tell just a little bit of summary of what has actually been happening with prion diseases. And then also, because I am working more in protein folding diseases, and how can we, since this is a technique, this is at its root a problem of protein folding, how can we actually use what we know about protein folding and the prion protein itself to kind of address the issue and maybe eventually come up with a treatment for these diseases. Okay. So prions themselves were initially found to be infectious pathogens that could cause these fatal neurodegenerative diseases in humans or in other species. So the main forms are sheep get scrapie. Now we know that cows get what's called mad cow disease, and then in humans the form is called familial or Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. And basically the BSE, which is the technical term for mad cow disease, bovine spongiform encephalopathy, it basically means sponge brain. I mean, the cells in the brain die and get abnormal conformations, and basically abnormal, cells die and it looks like a sponge. And if you just think about that, that's not really something that you would want to have happen to you. And the disease manifests itself primarily in animals, so sheep and cows, by having motor problems and just general sorts of difficulties moving and different types of problems like that. And it is fatal. So in the human forms, initially it was found that there were just like any sort of genetic disease, there were families that had this disease so it was called familial Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, and it's a rare disease of incidence of about 1 per million. And some of these cases are genetic, like in the familial cases. But there's also, it could happen, a new mutation in the person, so that would be a sporadic mutation. So a lot of cancers and things like that are caused by just having a spontaneous DNA mutation that leads to some sort of altered protein that causes disease. So in that regard, the Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease can either be inherited by a germline mutation from your parents or a new mutation within the body. And what's really different about the prion diseases that sets it apart from pretty much all other human diseases is that you can also get it infectious. It has an infectious component, and that's really kind of what fits into this class. And what's been in the news most recently is basically getting this by eating contaminated meat. So eating contaminated beef has been linked to a transfer of this disease to humans. But also traditionally it was found more through things like contaminated material, things that the doctors did, so contaminated surgical equipment, electrodes, things like that. There was also a case in New Guinea. The Foray tribe actually had a history of ritualistic cannibalism. And what I've heard about this case is basically the tribe had been going along there. It doesn't appear that there was any sort of history of cannibalism. And what's thought to have happened is that someone in this tribe developed the sporadic case of Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, or Kuru, and they basically kind of went crazy. And the rest of the villagers thought that the person had been possessed by God and that this was a favorable thing. And so they began this process of ritual cannibalism, thus spreading the disease to basically the rest of the tribe. And up to 10% of the tribe actually was killed from that disease. So I just wanted to give a rundown of the different forms of these prion diseases that exist. So kuru, like I mentioned here, was spread through ritualistic cannibalism. The Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, so the CJD, is the main human form of this disease, and that can either be caused by infection from a contaminated brain. This is predominantly through some sort of surgical or other type of medical procedure. There's the VCJD, which is the specific form of this disease that's caused by eating mad cow tainted beef. The familial form, which is the main case of either the germline mutations or the novel mutations within the prion protein itself. And scrapie is basically the same disease manifesting itself in sheep or cattle. Mink can also get it. And then there's also there's examples of these exotic ungulates. And probably these cases, the exotic ungulates here and the BSEs, these were probably a result of this practice where animals were fed infected feed that then transmitted the prion protein and caused the disease that way. So my guess is that the exotic ungulates were probably in a zoo. Oops, sorry, I lost my pointer. And that basically the sheep here and the cattle here were eating the contaminated food. And that might be also what happened with the minks. There is one other main population of animals that has this disease, and this is chronic wasting disease in mule deer and elk. So this is something that's important for those of us living in Idaho and Washington. And I'll talk a little bit about that also. So there's another form of prion disease that I think is just kind of interesting. I've never heard that much about this gene or about this disease, but there's something called fatal familial insomnia. So if you ever think you had a bad night sleeping, just and couldn't sleep well, it could be worse. So it really is caused by people are not able to sleep, and it causes basically messes up their brain chemistry, and they die from it. So one thing that's really different about prion disease is, like I said, is this possibility of either getting this disease inherited from the parents, or a new mutation, or getting it infective. And most human diseases that you can think of, they're either caused by inheritance of a mutant gene, so lots of things, you know, that you've heard about, cystic fibrosis, muscular dystrophy, all caused by inheritance of a mutant gene or new gene. Or the other alternative is basically bacterial or viral infection. And so when it was first found that these prion diseases had some sort of infective nature, the main things that people wanted to do is say, well, it must be either viral or bacterial, or maybe somehow the virus or bacteria is changing something that's already present to make it into this disease form. And so it was really kind of a struggle to try to figure out how the disease fits into this. And there was really kind of a lot of desire to kind of fit it into the mold of what was already known to cause a disease. And so there's a lot of interest in trying to figure out what is the actual nature of the infectious particle. And here, basically, the early studies focused on scrapie, because that was really a very, so before the mad cow epidemic in Great Britain, there was no beef form of the disease. Scrapie was really the primary exposure that people had to this disease, other than the very rare Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. And so people used to do these studies where they basically would take infected sheep, they knew that the brain is infected, and they would do these really crude studies of basically grinding up sheep brains and then exposing, implanting them into the brains of other sheep and then eventually mice models and trying to figure out how the disease spread. And sure enough, they could find that if you did this, if you took part of an infected sheep brain and basically placed it on top of a brain of another animal, that disease could be transmitted. And so by doing that, then they could basically treat the brain beforehand with all sorts of things to try to figure out what would prevent it from being able to be spread. So the primary things that they tried were all things that they knew would kill if it had any DNA or RNA, the main genetic material, or any sort of bacteria or virus would be completely obliterated by these treatments. And they really found that those treatments were not effective. And so that really opened up this idea that it was a completely new type of pathogenic agent that was causing these diseases. And along these same types of experiments, they found that the one thing that could destroy the scrapie agent was that if you use treatments that destroyed proteins. And so the proteins are generally, you know, the proteins are the main enzymes or basically any sort of thing in your body that you can see, that's pretty much proteins. The DNA the DNA encodes the proteins, but the proteins are generally themselves what's actually doing the work in the body. And this really suggested that it was actually a protein infectious agent, and this was really a very novel mechanism of thought. And so Stanley Prusiner came up with this term of prion, which stands for proteinaceous and infectious. And although he did eventually win the Nobel Prize in Physiology in 1997, he really was very, somewhat like Socrates, he was actually very outspoken and he was very controversial. And he was really vilified for this idea that a protein could be some sort of infectious agent. And so he really had to endure a lot of criticism of his work. But as a result of that, there's been really, really rigorous testing of this hypothesis. And so now it really is widely accepted that the protein itself is the infectious agent. The prion, the infectious particle, does not contain any sort of nucleic acid, and this protein itself that can be transmitted from species to species that can actually cause a disease and be infectious. So what do we know about this prion protein? Well, the gene, so what they did was they basically took brains that had, brains that were either uninfected or infected and tried to figure out what was different. And they were able to narrow down a specific protein that was altered in the diseased brains versus the non-diseased brains. And once they had the protein identified, they were able to use standard molecular biology techniques to identify what protein was actually, what the gene was that was encoding this protein. And they isolated this gene in 1982. And to the surprise of many, I think, it's a protein that's normally expressed in your brain. It's actually expressed in lots of tissues throughout the body, but it's most highly expressed in the brain. And basically what's happening here is the protein basically becomes bad. So it's a protein that's normally present, something happens to it, and now it no longer isn't functional. It actually has these negative functions that can cause disease. And once the gene was isolated, they were able to basically confirm that this gene, mutations in this gene, or some sort of change in this gene could cause a disease, because when they went back and looked at some of these familial pedigrees that had these prion diseases like Creutzfeldt-Jakob, they were able to find that these people had mutations in their DNA that encoded this protein that actually changed the protein structure and protein sequence and protein structure. And one example of this is that it had been known for a while that, and this is just one example that I found that was known. And so within Israel, there were Jews from Libya that developed CJD 30 times more often than other Israelis. And a lot of times, these types of epidemiological studies are really helpful in trying to pinpoint some sort of cause in things, because you say, well, they probably have basically the same eating habits, and they basically have the same sort of environmental stimulants all around them. And this is one way that they were able to say that there really, there might be a genetic link. And they eventually found that the Libyan Jew population had a particular mutation in this gene that made them more susceptible to this disease. So there really was this strong genetic link and evidence that if you have mutations in the prion protein, that can cause disease. So here I just kind of gave you this for those of you that aren't molecular biologists and don't really have a good idea of the types of experiments that people in molecular biology would do. This is one example of how they basically found that it's the protein itself that's altered. So this really is a different idea that the protein that I have in my body versus the protein that you have in your body there might be something fundamentally different about it, and particularly that something different about that protein has now been altered to give it the property of being able to confer disease onto another organism. And so here, basically, again, like I said, they used to do these really crude experiments like fractioning brains and trying to figure out what was different. And basically, they were able to. So if you look at here, so this is basically, you can isolate proteins out of any sort of sample. And for those of you that watch some of these crime type shows, these are some of the types of things that they do in those also. So this is called a Western blot, where you can take proteins from a sample, run them out in gel, which basically separates them by size, and then you use an antibody, which specifically recognizes a particular protein. And here, lanes 1 and 2 are from a brain that was not did not have the prion disease, and lanes 3 and 4 were from an infected animal. And this is basically just showing how this the antibody is recognizing this particular protein, the same pretty much in these two different animals, the uninfected and the infected. But what's different here is that if you treat the sample with something called a protease, which basically will chew apart different proteins. In this sample, you can see it's very effective at basically eliminating any of the protein that's there. And that's basically proteases are basically something that helps chew up the protein so that it's gone. And it's, they're basically similar things that we have in our guts to help us when we digest food. And what's surprising is that in the infected animals, the prion protein here basically only gets partially chewed up. And this is the diagram here. Basically, just this is a typical representation of the diagram of the amino acid sequence of the prion protein here. This is the PRPC, the normal form that's present. This is the same size is shown is actually observed in infected animals, but instead you get this protease resistant core here, which is basically the same here, that happens in infected animals. And so this is one of the ways to basically test for animal to make sure the animals have this type of disease even now. Because it's only infected animals that if you treat their samples with these proteases, you'll get this resistant core here. So that's a current laboratory test that you can use, and it's one of the distinguishing methods to test for whether an animal, if the suspected, might actually have this. And importantly, this particular fragment isn't observed in other neurodegenerative diseases. So it's pretty much just these types of diseases that are prion diseases, as opposed to other sort of neurodegenerative diseases, are characterized by this. So that really helps to point that this is a causative agent or something specific that occurs within these prion diseases. Okay. So what's really striking about the prion protein itself is that even when the prion protein is the same amino acid sequence, it actually can be in two different shapes. And so what's really different about this is that most proteins are, it's kind of an established dogma in the field that a protein really only has one active form. So a protein gets synthesized, it has one particular shape that it is functional in, and if anything happens to that, it's no longer functional or has some sort of other function or some sort of regulatory role. But what happens with these prion proteins is that they can actually undergo this conformational switch to look different. And so, again, for those of you that aren't as familiar with protein folding and different protein structures, so proteins are all built up of the same 22 amino acids, and these 22 amino acids within the protein sequence themselves are basically found in, there's two common structural motifs, either an alpha helix, which is shown here by this helix structure here, or beta sheets. So these red and green things with arrows are basically referred to as, this is a common depiction of a structure known as a beta sheet. And so this is the normal form of the prion proteins. Like I said, this is a protein that's normally present within the brain. And the normal form of the protein has been solved the way you do this by crystallization methods, standard biochemical method. And you can see that it's pretty much has these alpha helices with some of these inflexible or loop regions here. And what happens in the prion form is that the protein switches, and so now it has kind of basically a mixture of beta sheets and alpha helices. And so this is a very big shift that a protein does from going to from the normal form to the prion form. And so this is just a way to kind of depict that in another way so that it's a little bit easier to imagine what might be going on. And basically what happens in this case is the protein goes from being the normal cellular form, which would be the triangle form, or just or another way to think about this is a soluble form. And this is the normal functioning form of this protein. And something happens when the protein is either mutated or when it's somehow converted by interacting with a prion protein, and it becomes converted to this new shape. So in this depiction, this would be the alpha helical form. This would be the form that has both alpha helices and beta sheets. And what occurs in these prion diseases is that once this new conformation of this of a protein has been once it's been converted to this new form, it actually has the property of making all the other protein molecules in the body, and within a particular cell, there might be numerous different, there might be multiple, like thousands of copies of the same protein within a cell. The prion protein actually has the ability to convert a protein that's already present in the cell to this new conformation. And so that's depicted here basically as forming these aggregates, where you now get lots of these cross material, this prion form, and it forms these aggregates. And one of the remarkable things about these diseases as far as studying them in test tubes is that this procedure, or this process of converting all of the soluble material, soluble protein, normal form, to this prion form, you can actually detect these aggregates and grow them in a test tube. And that's an example of here. These are some of these prion rods or amyloid structures that can actually occur, and you can just do this in a test tube. So this is another test that people have for checking the ability of whether or not some sort of protein sample has one of these infectious prions, is you can take your suspected prion sample, mix that with soluble protein, and basically see if you end up getting these rods formed. Basically, from a lot of the work within the protein folding field is really trying to understand how it is that this conformational switch actually changes. Because basically, once you have this prion form, then that's the bad seed. And so within the protein folding field and the people that study these prion diseases, there's a lot of emphasis in basically trying to figure out whatever you can do to either stop this or to increase the probability that this will go back to this within some sort of folding reaction. And part of the work that people do is they've gone back, and now that we have this structure of the prion protein, you can go back and basically figure out what amino acids are specifically mutated in some of these familial forms. And basically these things here that kind of have marked out differently. So with these sticks things, different depiction of these amino acids. These are just some of the positions where people have been found to have specific mutations in the prion protein that cause disease. And essentially, they're at places that destabilize this particular shape or conformation of the protein and make it much more likely that this will actually form. And the types of things that people can do is, if you have this particular prion protein, you can introduce these mutations in the test tube, and then basically you can follow over a time course and get an idea of how much more likely that protein is to convert to this form. So there's kind of some standard assays that you can do confirming that it really is these mutations that cause disease really do form this particular form within the cell. Okay. And so the main things that can lead to prions then are these inherited mutations. Basically, if you inherit a protein that has a propensity to form this, that can then, once you have, and one thing that Greg talked about is not knowing what kind of dose or what kind of level is necessary. I think it's still not really clear how many molecules have to, how many of these particular molecules you have to have before you can effectively convert all of the protein to this type of form, but it's thought to be very low. And whether that means that, you know, extrapolating that to actually eating, you know, one single prion molecule, I don't know whether that's really known yet. But basically, in test tubes at least, you can have very small amounts of this particular prion form, and it can very effectively convert all of the available protein to these larger aggregates. And so the main genetic type diseases, you would either inherit the mutation, this initial mutation that's going to cause this, or get a sporadic mutation. But really what we're going to be talking mostly the rest of this talk today is really this idea that you can basically be infected by a protein that's already in this converted form, and that then can then manage to convert all of the protein that you already have to something that can then be aggregating, causing disease. And so it's important to say here that even though in animals that have been infected with BSE and gotten mad cow disease or gotten scrapie in this way, they only have a very small amount of the original infectious agent, and the rest of the aggregates or the rest of the disease-causing formations in the brain are actually just comprised of the native material that was already present in the brain. So it's not like this. This infectious material, it's not like a virus where you get infected with a small amount of the protein and then it multiplies and then causes some sort of disease. Here it's actually a conversion by this bad seed or prion form actually changes the protein that's already present within a particular person to cause these aggregates in this disease. And this is very rare, and so there are actually, even though there's a lot of talk about mad cow disease, and obviously it has affected a lot of people, and it's a very real concern, there are a lot of kind of safeguards within the system to prevent this from happening. And so there seem to be species-specific limitations on how infectious a particle can be from species to species. And it's generally thought that an infectious particle from one species is going to be much more able to infect a species, the similar species and a different species. And also the time that something takes to either, the time that something can take to actually be able to convert all of the available protein into these aggregates can actually vary. So there's this lag time in these diseases, and I have an example of that later. But there's evidence that there is a lag time, and then the question really is, we don't know how, you know, at what point do you consider yourself safe? This is one of the questions. If there's a lag time, then you don't know how long to give that a lag time before you can say that the disease isn't going to occur. Okay, so basically in the cases of bovine spongiform encephalopathy or mad cow disease, the primary disease-causing event is that pretty much presumed to be that ingestion of a prion form of a protein, ingesting that will somehow then convert all the protein that you already have. And I think that the actual route of infection is not exactly clear as far as I know. There's been some debate over whether it merely is just in eating contaminated beef or other meat. There's also some evidence that perhaps you need to absorb it through your skin, some sort of, like if there was some sort of cut in your hand or something like that, which might occur during cooking or preparing the meat, to something like that, that it might be more susceptible to getting the disease if you get it through the skin and it directly into the blood supply rather than through eating it in the gut. So a lot of people have heard about mad cow disease, but they don't really know a lot of the specifics of the epidemic. So the primary BSE epidemic was in Great Britain from 1988 to 1998. And it's estimated that over 1 million cattle were infected by eating this contaminated feed that contained these prion proteins. And eventually, about 160,000 dairy cows died during this epidemic. And probably a lot more of the animals, the reason that it is a fatal disease, so basically you would expect that all animals that got it would actually die from this disease. But since there is this lag time between the disease manifests itself, and that time period is usually about 5 years, well, most of the animals that were infected were probably slaughtered as part of the natural life of cattle being raised for feed. They're actually slaughtered before the disease actually manifested itself. And so the 160,000 dairy cows dying was more mostly because those were the animals that lived the longest, and that's they basically weren't killed before they died of the disease. And the disease pretty much has been traced to a common source epidemic, was that they were eating this contaminated meat and bone meal that was fed to dairy cows. And so I'm not going to talk too much about the meat and bone meal, but basically what they were doing was taking bones and scrap parts from animals and grinding them up and then feeding them back to other animals. So that was basically very similar to the ritualistic cannibalism of the Kuru of the Fori tribe that led to Kuru. Was basically that if you take the brainstem and bones and then feed them to other animals, it really increases the likelihood of transmission. So there are a couple things that just kind of to try to limit the kind of the scare factors of some of these diseases. So one of the things that is important, I think, to say is that people have been eating sheep for a long time. And that basically before this BSE epidemic, there hadn't been any evidence of transmission from the disease from infected sheep to humans. So scrapie had actually been documented for a couple hundred years that animals would actually get this disease, but there weren't any cases of animals getting the disease directly from eating scrapie-infected animals or animals that might have been in the same, you know, related to other animals that got scrapie. And so it's not clear whether there is just this one of these species barriers where an infected eating infected sheep meat basically isn't it just doesn't cause this conversion of the human proteins, and it's more likely thought that basically what happened is that maybe the sheep form is able to more efficiently infect cows. But that basically would never happen because cows don't run around eating sheep. And so it was only through this artificial process of generating this meat and bone meal and feeding that to the sheep that they were ever, or feeding that to the sheep and cows, that the cows were ever infected. And further evidence that this was really something caused by this artificial situation of having this meat and bone meal is that until this outbreak, there had been no documented cases of any cows even having mad cow disease. And so this really was a new type of disease that was basically brought on by these artificial feeding practices. It is known, just want to go over some of the evidence that it is really known that the BSE can be transmitted. And basically, again, some of these same sort of crude type of experiments. You can take brain extracts from BSE infected from cattle with BSE, and it can cause disease in cattle, sheep, mice, pigs, and mink. And luckily, early on in the epidemic, the epidemiologists were able to trace it to this artificial bone meal. And so in 1988, when the first cases were occurring, they banned the feeding of this meat and bone meal to sheep and cattle. And one of the problems now is that some of these sporadic cases that have popped up in the past couple years, some of the speculation is that people basically stashed away some of this feed and that it might still be around in some places, that people never actually destroyed it and got rid of it, and that that might actually cause some of these rare sporadic cases popping up. But basically, so like I said, there's this lag time, and basically in 1988, the practice of feeding the meat and bone meal to sheep and cattle was banned, and in 1994, the first case appeared in humans. And they called the new disease that occurred in humans variant CJD. And so this is to distinguish it from either the sporadic or the familial form. And one of the ways that they could distinguish this, that this was a new form of CJD and it wasn't just the standard forms that had already been described, was that the people that were getting this disease were very young. So typically the Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease occurs later in life. These were teenagers and young adults that were getting it. So there were already 25 cases in 1998. And there's also, in addition to the age of the patient, there's also a different pattern of neurodegeneration. And I didn't have any, I didn't bring any slides of that, but and mainly because I'm not a neuropathologist and some of the differences aren't really that clear to me. But based on the types of brains that are affected and the type of damage that you can see, it's clearly a very different type of pattern between the people that get VCJD and CJD, and there really are differences. So this graph is one that I think really underscores the transmission and the lag period of the BSE epidemic. So if you see here, basically this is this first line is basically looking at the BSC epidemic itself. So these are number of UK BSC cases confirmed. So 1988, and then it really peaked 1992, and then it's been steadily dropping off, so that there's basically no new cases in the UK now. And one of the things about this graph is it really demonstrates the lag period of here was when the feed ban was initiated, and then it was basically about 5 years later that you could really see the number of animals peaking that had the disease. So part of this is just the normal lag time that it takes for this disease to actually manifest itself in an infected individual. And then here, which I think is also really striking, is mapping the occurrence of number of cases of EJD deaths confirmed and probable. And so you can see basically the first cases appeared, and basically here we're steadily rising. And it looks as though here some of the cases are actually starting to drop off. I don't know what the numbers are for 2004, 2005 in this particular graph form. But you can see that just as there was kind of a nice bell curve here, you're basically starting to see a bell curve here. And part of the question is how much is this going to tail off over here? So the numbers, even though if you think about a million cattle were infected, and it's really hyped up in the media as this is something that really is a widespread concern. While it's not diminishing the fact that this is a disease that can be contracted from eating infected meat, the number of deaths is still pretty low. So 180 people in the United Kingdom have died from VCJD. I think there's only been a couple cases in the United States, and I believe one of them just died last year. There is some evidence that there's a genetic predisposition to get this disease. So just as there are mutations in the prion protein that's already present in your body that can lead to the sporadic cases, there are basically certain mutations in this gene that make people more susceptible to getting it. So I know that my numbers are different here. I know that the article that I read, when only 130 people had died, all of them had only had one particular genotype or one particular form of the prion protein in them. So if you think about, so genetically, we have two copies of every gene basically in our body, one from each of our parents. And most, if not all, and I put in the if not all because I haven't seen it again with these 180 people, most of these people had two exact same versions of the protein that they inherited from their parents, and that this is a particular amino acid, methionine 129, is present. Some people don't have methionine 129. And it had been known previously that people containing this particular mutation were more likely to develop the sporadic Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. So there is something about the protein that has this particular amino acid at this particular position that seems like it's more likely to be able to be converted to the prion form and then end up causing disease. And one thing that I think is still up in the air is that it's not known basically whether these are the only people that can be infected by the infected and susceptible to prion diseases, or if these are just the people that are affected first, and that it might just be a longer lag time in people that have other sorts of genetic combinations. And that still is, unfortunately, due to the nature of this disease having this lag time, we don't know how long of a lag time might be necessary before people with other particular before other protein coding sequences in people might actually be affected. But here again, too, so 30% of the UK is homozygous for this mutation. So if you think about these numbers, and I don't know how many people are in the UK, but it's a lot, basically the numbers are still pretty low. So if you imagine 30% of all the people in the UK would potentially be susceptible to getting this disease based on their genetic makeup, only 180 people have actually gotten it. So that's really saying that the transmission rate really is quite low, and obviously it's a significant risk, but it isn't quite as high as you might think from hearing some of the discussions about it. So what can be done about prion diseases? Well, I think one of the main things is that obviously eliminating whatever the whatever practice it is that exposes that really amplifies the prion and gets it much more likely to be exposed to people. So these two graphs are basically again looking at the number of BSE cattle, the occurrence of the disease in relation to when the food, when the meat and bone meal was being fed to these animals, and basically as soon as it was recognized as a risk and people stopped using that, you saw this lag time of the disease occurring, but then that basically started falling off as soon as the risk was known from using these feeding practices. And again, similarly, within the 4A tribe, basically as soon as someone went in and said, you know, maybe eating these people, you know, maybe in being involved in this ritualistic cannibalization isn't really such a good idea, as soon as they stopped doing that, the disease incidence within that tribe really dropped off. And so this really suggests that if you basically just eliminate the practices, you know, like a lot of other infectious diseases, you know, if you have safe eating practices, there's a good chance you can actually eliminate these risks from the population. One of the things I think is really interesting that they're doing, and they're obviously, since the BSE epidemic was in the UK, they're taking a much more active and proactive approach to trying to eliminate this disease from the population. One of the plans is to selectively breed sheep that are resistant to the scrapie. And just as humans have particular mutations that might make them more susceptible to getting the prion diseases, through doing all these different studies of you know, these crude studies of basically taking infected brain and then from sheep and infecting new sheep, they have found over the years that there are certain sheep that appear to be genetically resistant to getting the disease. And so the idea is that if you can basically selectively breed those sheep, that then you basically will greatly reduce the chance that any further sheep will develop scrapie, and then you'll basically be removing the prion risk from the population. And also in here, a similar thing could be happening with the mad cow disease. So if you recall, basically before this practice of feeding meat and bone meal, there were no cases of mad cow disease, at least not any that were documented. So this really suggests that if you can basically clear out you know, the particularly bad prion form that was able to jump species and infect all these animals, that there might be a real chance of basically being able to just eliminate the risk or greatly reduce it. So there are these plans to breed the scrapie-resistant sheep, and I don't want to make it sound like this is going to be the cure-all to any of these prion diseases, because just in doing a couple checks in the last couple days, it is still possible to induce prion diseases in scrapie in these scrapie-resistant sheep. So there are problems with this idea in general, but it's better than nothing. So other animals have prion diseases. So like I said, a deer and elk may have chronic wasting disease. And it's very similar to scrapie as far as some of the effects that it has on animals. Some of the populations are, some of the estimates, at least I've seen with elk, are that less than 5% of elk have this disease or can actually get this disease. That's still a very high number. The one actually that, the situation that I'm more familiar with is chronic wasting disease was actually identified in Wisconsin in February 2002, and I was living in Madison, Wisconsin, or actually I was living outside of Madison, Wisconsin in February 2002, and I routinely ate deer that people had shot in that area, and basically the CWD was identified in deer basically right where I was living. And it's since been found that basically there's really been a lot of interest in trying to figure out why the CWD basically appeared in deer all of a sudden, and basically trying to understand its transmission, because there are a lot of deer in Wisconsin. And they've done some sequencing, and basically they found that 86 to 90% of the deer in that particular area of Wisconsin actually have a form of the prion protein that would actually appear to make them susceptible for these prion diseases. And hunting in Wisconsin is it's very popular. So it's really a very, very big concern right now to try to figure out whether or not the disease might be eventually transmittable from deer and elk to humans. And right now there isn't any evidence. There's no conclusive evidence that humans can get a prion disease from eating infected elk or deer meat. There's some circumstantial evidence, but nothing has been proved at this point. And that's something that I'm sure that the epidemiologists are really going to be looking at, is trying to figure out, studying all these people that eat deer meat, potentially infected deer meat in Wisconsin, and see if there's now a rise in CJD cases. So some of the ways that, other ways that since CJD is infectious, and that there is this species barrier. So one of the main concerns, I think, about CJD and the mad cow epidemic is also this concern that once it gets into a human population, if it really takes hold in the human population, then it's going to be much more likely that it could then spread from humans to humans. And these are just some of the cases that it's been shown that there has been transmission from human to human. Many of these are some sort of surgical procedures. So improperly sterilized depth electrodes that might be used in some sort of neurosurgeries or neurophysiological studies, transplanted corneas, human growth hormone. There's been 90 cases where people have basically contracted human growth hormone because it was basically taken from other people. Dermatographs, gonadotropin derived from cadaver pituitaries, surgical instruments, and again, some of these cases, since the incubation period can vary from 1 to 20 years, number one, it suggests that some forms of the protein are going to be more infectious than others, but it also raises a lot of questions. When you have such a long incubation period, you don't know when it could have started spreading throughout the population. And it's still unknown whether it can be transmitted through blood, although I just saw a paper just came out in the last couple weeks that there have been the prion form was actually shown in blood. But in any case, the American Red Cross now bans blood donations from people that have lived in the UK for a significant amount of time and thus might have been exposed to prion disease. So there is a very real concern that if it were in people, that it could easily spread to a number of other people. And because of these properties of that's being an infectious protein that isn't normally degraded by things that you think about killing viruses and bacteria and DNA, that it really needs to be thought of as really its own risk, and destroying it actually is a much bigger problem. So then I just wanted to finish up, I think, on talking about some of these new cases of CJD in Idaho. So some of you may have heard this and some of you may not have heard this, but basically just this year, 2005, 9 people have died in Idaho this year from suspected CJD. And so if you think about the normal incidence of CJD is 1 per million, so we have 1.3 million people here in Idaho and there's been 9 cases. So this is obviously a spike in this disease. They're falling short so far of calling this a cluster, which gives it its own special importance within groups such as the CDC. Importantly, this isn't VCJD, and it's not linked to the BSE epidemic. So this isn't some sort of hidden mad cow that might have gotten out and might have infected these people. Part of the way they know this is because of some of these biochemical tests and the different patterns of neurodegeneration that they can look at in people that were affected. But this is not tied to the BSE epidemic. This is more the sporadic cases of CJD that are occurring. They're just trying to figure out why they're occurring. So just to give you a little bit of information on these people, so there's been 9 cases in Idaho that have been suspected. One of these, they've actually ruled out that it wasn't CJD. 2 of the cases have actually been confirmed after autopsy and shown that it really was a prion disease, it really was CJD. Some of the other cases, so 2 are pending, but part of it is that the other four cases, then I guess, basically the answer is not going to be able to be determined, and basically that's because in order to determine that it really was a prion disease, you have to have a special autopsy, and in most cases that wasn't done. And some of the reasons, some of the things that contribute to the fact that these special autopsies weren't done is that they're actually very expensive. And I'm not sure, I don't have the information on whether the health authorities actually helped defray some of the costs or whether the family is responsible for those costs. I don't know about that. But I have seen that basically a lot of morticians are actually very hesitant to perform the embalming techniques and these autopsies on these suspected cases. And that's partly because if you think about the standard sterilization procedures aren't going to work because this is a prion, this is a protein agent, it's not the standard viral or bacterial agent. You need to have special decontamination techniques. You need to have a chemical solution soak and then heating for an hour as opposed to something like autoclaving. And that's basically because the nature of the prion itself is actually just, it's a very stable protein and it's harder to get rid of. So it's just in general, a lot of people are basically very hesitant to work with this protein if they don't have to. Right now, there's a lot of trying to just figure out whether there's a common link between affected people that have this disease. And the early cases were all in southern Idaho, but there is now one up in northern Idaho, north of here, actually. They've looked, really done detailed epidemiological studies of 4 women that were basically suspected CJD. I think 2 of these were confirmed. These were all white females over the age of 55, and they've really been trying to figure out, is there some sort of common place of employment, common occupation, common travel habits. They haven't found any of those. They've looked at, I like the way that they phrase this, no common unusual eating habits, so it kind of makes you wonder what kind of unusual eating habits would be common. No common animal exposures, surgical procedures, or medications. And so it's really trying to figure out what is causing this. And I haven't seen anything yet where they have looked to see, to try to determine whether or not this is a actual mutation in the protein coding sequence or not. I haven't seen any information on that. So this is still under investigation as far as trying to figure out why these cases are appearing in Idaho. Like I said, there's not really any sort of information. Part of this, you know, there is this long lag period, and so you don't know at what point you should stop looking. I mean, these might just be the first occurrences, and there might be additional cases later on. And at this point, it's still really unclear what's causing this. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot more investigation as far as trying to find out some sort of common behavioral things or environmental studies that might be causing this disease, or you know, it could just be random. You know, there's still that question. So I did find this website for those of you interested in this type of disease, or basically any of the diseases that are kind of out in the news. So the avian flu pandemic, any sort of bioterrorism agents. There's this website here, and basically through the links you can go ahead and you can find basically any of the common biological type threats that are available. You can click on those, and they have all sorts of latest information. That's where I got the press report for one of these cases in Idaho. So I was going to talk about, I'll just briefly talk about this a little bit. And so one thing I just wanted to bring up is that, so there's a lot of work right now really trying to understand what it is about the proteins misfolding that cause these different rod shapes and these aggregations. And if you see this picture here with these rods, Other proteins can actually aren't related at all to the prion protein can actually form these same types of structures, and some of these other proteins are also very relevant to human diseases. And so there's a lot of interest even in just trying to figure out what it is about a protein that makes it be able to convert to this new form that can cause these aggregates, and how can we really understand that within the cell and eventually come up with some sort of treatment. So I'll skip part of that. And basically I'll just say that these similar rod-like structures are observed in other neurodegenerative diseases. So Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, Huntington disease, there's lots of diseases. There's also, there's just a lot of them, actually, where a common mechanism of the disease is actually forming these misfolded proteins that form these large aggregates. And so it's thought that by understanding how prions are able to go from being basically the soluble form to these rod-like structures of the aggregates in the cell, if we can really get a handle on how the prion is converting other proteins to these aggregates, that can really help understand not just these prion diseases, but also these other neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, and Huntington's disease. And so then I was going to talk a little bit about using a model system of yeast, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, to deal with that. But instead, I think, because the time, should I just keep going?
Yeah.
Okay, all right, I'll go ahead. So basically, just to give you a little plug for basic molecular biology research and working in a model organism such as yeast. So I do work in budding yeast. It's basically the same yeast that's used in bread and beer making. So it has other uses also. And one of the things that we can really do in yeast to look at prion biology is you can imagine that yeast grows very fast, and we basically can use it, and it's cheaper and faster than using alternative methods. So I just wanted to kind of give you a little bit of idea of how you can even use something like yeast that obviously doesn't have brains or single cellular organisms. How can you use something like a yeast to try to understand a complex neurobiological disease like prion disease or Huntington's disease or Parkinson's disease? And basically one of the things that came out when people were looking at prion biology is that, let me go back here for just a second, excuse me. So there are some certain characteristics of prion proteins here, this protease-resistant core, having these two conformations, either these alpha helices or the switch to these beta sheets, or forming these rods in vitro, or being able to be transmitted from one cell to another without a DNA or RNA component. And basically, in looking at studying yeast, basically people found that even yeast has a certain number of proteins that are normally present in yeast that have some of these same types of characteristics of prion proteins. So they're not the same actual, some people call them prion proteins. I think for the purpose of this, I'll try to call them prion-like proteins. So, because all the prion diseases themselves are mutations in one particular protein, the prion protein, but these are prion-like diseases, they're prion-like proteins because they have these same characteristics of being able to undergo these two different folding conformations, and basically you can do this where you can add in a mutant protein and convert all the rest of the protein to these prion forms. So there's been some really interesting studies of basically trying to figure out, you know, even just evolutionarily, it's really interesting to think about why do organisms have these proteins that can undergo these harmful aggregations. And what's really been surprising to people is that yeast have at least four different proteins that have some of these properties of being able to form these aggregates and have these prion-like characteristics. And in some cases, it does appear that the prion form, the aggregated form, can actually be beneficial to certain cells. And this was really a paper that came out of Susan Lindquist's lab, who's now at the Whitehead Institute. And one of the things that you can do, basically with yeast, is you can study these aggregates and then just try to figure out, can you treat the yeast somehow and make the aggregates go away? And the reason we can use this is that the answer is yes. So I decided to give you a brief description of basically how we can do this. And so there's all sorts of cool little molecular biology techniques that we can use to study proteins and how they're behaving. And one of them is you can take a protein, basically any protein that you want, and you can fuse it to something called green fluorescent protein, which is called that because if you look at it under a microscope and you shine the right light on it, it will actually fluoresce and look green. So you can take yeast here, basically, and in this case, this would be basically the soluble form, the non-disease-causing form of the protein, fused to this green fluorescent protein. In this particular case, which is actually the prion protein called RANQ, R-N-Q, the normal protein form is the soluble form. It's kind of dispersed throughout the cell. This is actually the cell boundaries here and here. These are four different cells. But if the protein is going to basically be in the prion stage, all that green color forms these big aggregates, and you can basically see all the protein is forming in one of these big clumps here. And so these are basically the diagrams of what you can see. And that we also know that you can see these kind of intermediate size clumps where you see lots of little green dots instead of just one big green dot. And so this is really kind of now the mechanism for being able to, it's much simpler now. You can imagine working with yeast where you can look at these different colors of yeast. You can also use centrifugation techniques and other types of techniques to look at the size of these actual aggregates and show that it really is undergoing these different conformational changes that we know occur with prion proteins. So you can imagine this is much easier than doing these time-consuming and laborious assays of taking infected brain from one animal and then waiting for, especially considering the lag time before another animal develops the disease. And with yeast, basically you can see the conversion in some of these cases basically within days or weeks. And the main thing is that now that we have these assays, you can do all sorts of manipulations to the yeast to see if you can basically see one form or the other. And one of the things is that there's actually proteins that help other proteins fold in the cell called molecular chaperones. That's actually my area of expertise is molecular chaperones. And there's actually one particular molecular chaperone called HSP104 that can cure the yeast protein. So if you go back to here, you can take yeast that have this pattern here, and you basically overexpress the HSP104 protein, and it goes back to here. So there really are proteins in the cell that already have the mechanism to stimulate the cell to undergo the conversion between these different forms. And there's some chaperones that seem to help the aggregated form and some that help promote the unaggregated form. So right now there's really a lot of interest in trying to understand the interplay between those two different groups of proteins. And the idea is that eventually you can figure out something that will help shift the protein to the unaggregated form and hopefully help cure some of the diseases. And the one thing I thought I'd add here, which is my last little bit, is so the HSP104 protein is in yeast, but it's actually not in mammalian cells. And what they've done now in a mice model of Alzheimer's disease, Huntington's disease, you can actually overexpress this yeast protein, and that actually will help to prolong survival and reduce the aggregation of these rod-like type aggregates that form in these mice that have a mouse model of Huntington's disease. So this really is suggesting that this approach of trying to somehow alter the normal type of biology, the protein folding, and trying to shift this balance between helping something fold and helping it go into aggregated form, that there's really a chance to manipulate that pathway and help potentially help cure prion diseases and other diseases. And this is basically here. Just my last little plug here, basic research in model organisms really can help us understand basically how these prions are forming in the first place and how they're maintained and then stably passed on so that they can actually cause disease. And thank you. And I'd ask for questions, but since there's nobody here, I won't ask for questions. So thanks.
Jill, Dr. Johnson, thank you very much. That's a very, very nice lecture. Mm-hmm. I have one question for you. Mm-hmm. Prions first came on the scene, I guess, in the early 90s in the media. I heard them referred to as self-replicating life forms, which gave them this kind of mysterious alien sort of, oh my gosh, what exactly is this? It doesn't have DNA. It isn't life.
Right. But they're not really replicating. I think that's what really got people was that there was such this mindset that if it's going to be something infectious, that you had to think of it be more like a virus where it goes into the host cell and somehow replicates itself. Mm-hmm. And instead, now we know that it's basically converting the protein that's already there. So it's not actually replicating. It's just able to change everything that's already there.
Almost like a catalyst.
It's like a catalyst.
In that,
basically.
You know, it essentially changes another molecule, which then has a chain reaction of changing.
That's right.
It's very interesting, and in fact, I learned quite a bit.
Good, I'm glad.
On behalf of our class, Principles of Environmental Toxicology, we have this Socrates Lecture Award for you.
That's good, thank you.
And
I
it says
it.
Socrates Award Lecture 2005, Prions in Public Health, presented by Professor Jill Johnson.
Great.
So
thanks
you very
again.
Much. Mm-hmm. I do appreciate mm-hmm. that.
Sure, no problem.
And that gives you our 2005 Socrates Lecture, Prions in Public Health, again presented by Professor Jill Johnson of the University of Idaho. We hope you appreciate it. I know I learned quite a bit, and hopefully this information is something that you can use in terms of your own critical thinking about the next time you see mad cow disease. On the website in the course module, I've put a couple of important links to the Centers for Disease Control and the Food and Drug Administration to do follow-up analysis, more in-depth study of this particular disease and its etiology and epidemiology. With that, Jill, thank you very much, and thank you as well.